From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Two big local trials are winding up at this hour. Juries are expected to start deliberating in the retrial of Dwayne Moore, accused of four counts of first-degree murder in the September 2010 killings of four people, including a two-year-old boy. The first trial ended in a deadlock. Jurors will also start to deliberate today in the trial of former state treasurer Tim Cahill, accused of corruption during his 2010 run for governor. We'll be checking in later with Adam Riley, who's at the trial. First, joining me here is John Zaremba, Boston Herald reporter who's been following Dwayne Moore's retrial. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Emily.
So the big windup was all about Marcus Hurd, who in the first trial testified he could not identify any of the two people that were believed to be the shooters at the time. One of the people was let off, and Dwayne Moore, Edward Washington, his first name was?
That's right.
Edward Washington was essentially acquitted. Dwayne Moore, there was a deadlocked jury. But right after the verdicts, Marcus Hurd, who was the sole survivor, who was paralyzed from the neck down, said that he could now identify one of the shooters as Dwayne Moore, but he didn't do it.
That's right. There's a couple of ways that that happened. Apparently, he had made a comment to his girlfriend while he was watching TV, and the picture of Dwayne Moore came on TV, and he said, "Baby, that's the guy who shot me." The girlfriend has later said that that conversation never happened. He also, this is Hurd, also told the victim witness advocate that he recognized Moore at the trial. He said he recognized his face and bone structure. And those two, you have two different stories, and that automatically brings up, I think, kind of a problem for the prosecution, because when you have someone who can point the finger at the defendant in the courtroom and say, "That is the person who shot me," you want that person to be unimpeachable. And I think had the prosecution done that, would have been there's a lot of room for the defense to come back and bring up the girlfriend and said, "No, that conversation never happened," or to there's a lot of room to try to establish doubt there. And I think that the consensus, I talked to a number of lawyers who have been watching the trial and some other folks who have been watching the trial, and the consensus is that while the prosecution could have and they actually fought and in a hearing cleared Hurd to be able to testify to that effect, they thought that was probably a little
risky.
Bit more. Exactly.
You know, one of the things would have been interesting, though, because Marcus Hurd has talked about the code, the street code.
That's right.
And, the snitching, the no snitching code. And he said that during the first trial, he was basically honoring that code. And then when he saw one of the guys walk, never thinking in a million years that Edward Washington was going to walk, he claims when he saw somebody walk, he was going to throw out the code and go ahead and testify against Dwayne Moore. The interesting thing is that had that been kind of aired, had we heard somebody really talk about the street code, I think it would have been believable.
There's a chance that it would have been, and there's also a chance, again, where a defense attorney could have come back and said, you were keeping silent to protect yourself, and, and this is a case where, at the hearing, pardon me, Hurd, said to the judge, "I no longer want to be the one to protect a baby killer," and that, you have a situation where you have someone who didn't, who wasn't totally forthcoming in a case where four people, including a two-year-old, had died. And you also, I think it does become, again, problematic for the prosecution because you're putting someone on the stand who was already – he's just admitting that he has already lied under oath.
Right,
he wasn't totally truthful. He wasn't forthcoming.
He got a little testy yesterday.
He did. He started and he was speaking – he was speaking very quietly, actually so quietly that they had to, ring up a microphone on him and had to
remind
him.
Well, he can't move from the neck down, can he?
He can move his arms
a little bit.
He had difficulty moving his hands. But he certainly at some points did not have a problem raising his voice when it was clear that he had become annoyed at the defense attorney.
Yeah.
The defense attorney, John Amable, was doing what defense attorneys do. He was looking at, Hurd's comments to the police, at his grand jury testimony, at his trial testimony, and finding inconsistencies in the real details of the stories, the kind of clothing that they were wearing or the relative height of the assailants. And he was saying, "Well, you said this at this point and this at the other point." And Hurd just became, he became a little bit flustered at that, I think, as anybody would.
He said something like, maybe you can quote him directly, that now that I'm telling the truth, you're trying to challenge my reputation or something like
that.
He
did. Yeah, he did say, I'm trying to come clean, something along those lines. Yeah. I said, "I'm trying to come clean now, and now you're trying to sabotage my reputation."
Sabotage was the word that he used.
Yeah.
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 Did it come off that way in the courtroom?
Not really, because he didn't. Amable was, I think, pretty careful not to attack Hurd very much because, you know, mind you, Hurd was, you know, not the nicest guy in the book. You know, he has a criminal
yeah, right.
record, but I don't think any reasonable person would say that this man deserved. And he was shot in the back of the head, and he was doing a drug deal, was buying a bag of marijuana that night. But I don't think any reasonable person would say that, you know, he provoked or deserved what happened to him. And he's been left, you know, disabled by the shooting, and he's a victim. And I think, you know, Amable was careful not to go after him, not to attack him. What he did do, again, is what I said, is, you know, what defense attorneys do. He's looking at inconsistencies in the statement. He's saying, you know, are you being truthful here?
You know, one of the mysteries of this case has been all along, and, you know, four of them are dead and only Marcus Hurd is alive. And he came from another part of town. He was going over to buy these drugs. So he wasn't in on the plot, so to speak, to kill people. Was the why? I mean, you know, he had these two guys approach, the two guys who came to buy the drugs, you know, stopped the car, made them strip in the street. Then they marched them into the house. That's when Ayanna Flannery and her 2-year-old son, I guess, came downstairs. Then Simba Martin was also in that house.
That's right.
And somebody else. And the two guys came in at that point.
That's right. What happened, and Hurd, actually, this is the one thing he really did do yesterday. He described in very clinical detail how it went down. Said, you know, I came over at this time to buy a bag of marijuana. I parked here. I took this series of right and left turns to get to the house. He said, you know, Simba Martin came out. They were just, you know, chit-chatting for a minute. And at that point, somebody comes up to the car with a gun. And it makes it clear that this is going to be a robbery. They do march them back into the house. They order them to strip first, then they order them into the house where they take the two other, you know, the three other people out, including the child. You know, they had stolen a TV and a safe, and they, you know, they ordered the victims down. Hurd said he was ordered to lie down in some bushes, and that's when everybody was shot.
You wonder why?
But
take that risk to shoot all those people?
Well, we didn't get that answer from Hurd yesterday. You know, he didn't explain any sort of you know, escalation of emotion.
Yeah.
It was very he gave it in very clinical, very straightforward detail. You know, it didn't really say too much about what was said during the attack, other than he said, you know, the person who had the gun to his back told him to stop looking back.
Hmm. But did he indicate that maybe those two were high on drugs themselves?
No, I didn't really hear anything like that. And he was on the stand for quite a while.
Yeah. I mean, the first trial was very disturbing to observers like myself, and I'm sure you, but I can't even imagine the community or the families involved, because it appears as though a cold-blooded murder has walked.
You know, I think that the jury decided that. I mean, the jury decided that you know, the Commonwealth hadn't proven its burden against Edward Washington. Remains to be seen. Obviously, today we've got closing arguments.
He's still in jail, as I recall.
What's that?
He's still in jail, I think.
Washington?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe there were some other offenses, some priors. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think he's walking around out there about to kill somebody else, but he's still in jail.
Well, yeah. He, no matter all of that, he wasn't he wasn't convicted of this.
Yeah. So what is your anticipation for a deliberation on, I mean, how much of it did you see? How much did you get a good sense of how this is going to go one way or another?
It's, you know, it's hard to say. I think the deliberation, it depends, because the one real big difference in this trial is that the jury comes from Worcester County. So the trial day has been shorter because they've been, you know, they've boarded a bus in Worcester and been taken down the Mass Pike and going to Suffolk Court. Yeah, every day.
They can't take their own cars? Not that they would want to necessarily.
You know, I don't think they would want to, and I think it's probably just a matter of, you know, process and, you know, making sure everyone gets there at the same time, that sort of thing.
And did they do that? I didn't hear that. So that they had not a change of venue, but a change – I've never heard of that.
It was sort of a compromise on the motion to change venue. There was obviously a lot of emotion after the first verdict and a lot of sense that justice hadn't been served. So they went outside Suffolk County, went outside the meat of the Boston media market. They're bringing the jury in every day, and the jury's generally been starting around, I think, 10 and getting out around 3. So that, I think, has probably elongated the trial too, because you have that much less time to present, to present the evidence, just the day to day.
What's the demographic makeup of the jury? Do you know?
Let's see. I'm going from memory here. I want to say 8 men, 6 women, because there's 14. There's going to be 12 jurors and 2 alternates. That's about as well as I remember, just off the top of my head.
African American, Hispanic, do you?
Majority white jury, I believe.
Hmm. I wonder if that'll make a difference.
It's hard to say.
Yeah, I can't remember the racial component of the first one was different, as I recall.
It was different.
Yeah. What's your sense of deliberations?
Even as far as how long they're going to take. Yeah. Again, probably just from the flat logistics of getting to the courthouse and going back. I don't know. I think it's going to take possibly a little bit longer because they will be having a little bit farther to go to and from the court every day. So that's probably going to stretch it out. And the trial was very lengthy. I mean, we're talking
six weeks, wasn't it?
Jury selection started in mid-October, and the trial started in earnest. I want to say the 1st of November. It was either Halloween or the 1st of November, and it just ended yesterday. So this has been going on for a while.
And it's too bad these trials the second time around get less attention, but this is still a very important outcome.
Absolutely, yeah. It's still a huge trial.
Well, your colleague Peter Galzinis was going to call in if the closing arguments were all wrapped up, so I'm going to assume they are not, so we haven't heard from him. So.
It's possible that they weren't. I guess the latest was that they were going to do, the defense closing arguments at 11 this morning, break for lunch, and then go back with prosecution.
All right,
and then I believe the jury's going to go home for the day. I don't know that they're going to get to the case today. In keeping with their schedule, I think the most they would do today would probably be electing a foreman,
because
that can take a long time.
All right, John Zaremba, Boston Herald reporter following Duane Moore's trial. Thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. And not even giving you a minute to breathe, here comes Kara Miller back into the studio.
Hey, Emily. So if you had to name the most dangerous weapon out there, what do you think it would be?
Well, I guess a nuclear something.
That's certainly dangerous, but we're going to talk about bioterrorism today, which for all the sci-fi and over-the-top treatment that it gets, is emerging as potentially the next very sort of scary, viable weapon.
So Purell isn't going to help?
Yeah, I don't think all the Purell in the world is going to do it this time.
All right, I'm Emily Rooney.
And I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.